Well, good morning. It's good to see everyone out this morning. Good to have the opportunity to gather together. Hopefully we, over the course of this year, have been reminded of how good it is to have the chance to be together, to have the chance to assemble, to worship together, to sing, and to enjoy communion together. We find ourselves at the end of the year 2020. And I think I've mentioned this before, that my dad and I always used to go through an exercise, and still do in a lot of capacities, that at the end of every year, we always reflect on, you know, a year ago, would you have ever thought you were where you are today? And I got to be honest, on my list of things in 2019 end of year bingo, global pandemic was not there. It just wasn't on the board for me, at least. Maybe some of you had it there. I didn't see it coming. But there's a lot of things that happened this year that raised attention, that brought our minds to focus on different things, a lot of things that occurred in the course of this year, the pandemic, the social uprisings, the election, so many different things going on in our country that I think in many capacities shook us, that in many capacities caused us to question some things, to question some of our pre-held, preconceived notions, and to wonder at the end of the year, have we been changed from what we were at the beginning of the year? And in some capacities, I think we have been, and I don't think that's a bad thing. I think as Christians, we are constantly called to grow. We're constantly called to look at the world around us and to examine ourselves, to evaluate how are we doing as image bearers of Christ. Have we allowed things to perhaps cloud our vision? Have we allowed things to distract us from what we should be doing? And sometimes even, are there things that are going on in the world that give us better clarity into who we should be? Either by the course of things that we should be doing that we're not, or perhaps things that we're doing that we shouldn't do. And so what I want us to simply do at the end of this year is to look back, and I want us to look back at this year through a particular Old Testament word. And I want to look at this word and study this word, and it's a word that we've talked about, actually, this year. It's the word Havel. It's a Hebrew word, and it's most commonly used in the book of Ecclesiastes, and it's one of the center theme words of the book of Ecclesiastes. And so if you turn over there real quick, we will look at the first time, not the last time today, at the book of Ecclesiastes. We got the chance to go through the Old Testament this year as we looked at the wisdom literature. We looked at how the wisdom literature says some surprising things, particularly what we often conceive of as the wisdom literature. We think of how to live a good life and how to prosper, how to do certain things, and perhaps some of the proverbs that tell us what is the best way to live life. And then kind of come crashing in is the book of Ecclesiastes, which says in the first verse, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Perhaps your translation says meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless or pointless. And so that's how this word Havel is often translated in our English Bibles. It's meaninglessness, it's vanity, it's pointlessness. And that's a bold claim of Ecclesiastes author, the preacher, to say that all is meaningless. What I'm going to contend, and I talked a little bit about this when we went through Ecclesiastes, but we're going to dive into it a little bit deeper, is that I think this is there's a goal here in this translation, but I think it misses some of the meaning of this word. And this is just one of the difficulties of translating words from one language to another, is that when you're trying to translate particularly kind of a complex word or a word that's being used as a poetic image, well, then sometimes that becomes difficult to render that. And sometimes some of that poetic meaning, of which Ecclesiastes has a lot, some of that poetic meaning might be lost in the translation. And so I've used this example before. If I were to use an English phrase and I said, "The elephant and the donkey may always be fighting, but the eagle will always prevail." Now, you might be able to pick up pretty quickly that that's a political statement, that the Republican Party and the Democratic Party may always fight, but America will always prevail. Now, if you were to translate that statement directly into Hebrew or Greek or even Spanish or French, you might get the literal meaning of that word. You might get the eagle and the donkey and the elephant, but you wouldn't really understand what I was trying to say unless you understood some of the background and you understood how I was using those words. I'm not making a zoological comparison. I'm not talking about the nature of the animal kingdom. That statement would be a political statement. And so in that capacity, translation is difficult, and we've been incredibly blessed, and the Spirit of God has worked through many good men to bring us as good of translations as we have. But I want to take a look at this particular word, and maybe if we look at some of the other ways it's used in the Old Testament, we'll see some of the depth that this word means. The ultimate goal that I want to do is I want us to look at this past year, and I want us to ask what has been revealed as Hevel in our lives. What perhaps could we say with the author of Ecclesiastes, all of this has been Hevel. Turn over, if you will, on your Bibles to the book of 1 Kings, chapter 16. We're going to look at an early example of how this word Hevel is used. And so again, we're going to keep this definition in mind that English translations often have it as the idea of meaningless. And there is some truth to that. And I don't want to seem like this is solely bashing on translators, because again, I think they do an incredibly good work. And there is an element of that word meaningless that is contained in the word Hevel. In fact, when we see it used in the historical books, like the book of 1 Kings chapter 16, the word Hevel is actually often used to describe idols. Now, if you think about the idea of an idol, you could see how the word meaningless might make sense. Listen to how it's used here in 1 Kings chapter 16, talking about the rule of Omri, who was the father of King Ahab, one of the worst idolaters in Israel's history. It says, Omri did evil in the sight of the Lord and acted more wickedly than all who were before him. For he walked in all the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, and in his sins, which he made Israel sin, provoking the Lord God of Israel with their idols. Now I'm using the New American Standard Version. Your Bible might contain a phrase like their vain idols. Or if you have an older translation, it might literally say the word vanities. Well, that word that's translated idol, it's the same word here, Hevel. Now, the context of it is informing us that the author is talking about idols. And in talking about idols as Hevel, the author is kind of making a slam against idols. He's kind of mocking the idea of idols. And again, the author of Kings does not have much kind to say about Ahab and his family's addiction to idols. That they are vain things, they are empty things, they are meaningless things. There's a lot of truth to that idea. And so we see that idols are an example of something that is Hevel. And so idols are something that they're real. I mean, there's a physical substance to an idol. It's not an imaginary thing in the sense of there's a physical presence there. But there's no power behind it, there's no substance behind it. And so you might be able to point to an idol and say, oh yeah, that's the idol of Dagon. It's a physical thing, but there's no substance behind it. There's no real weight behind it. There is no power behind it, particularly compared to the great power of the God of Israel. And so we might see how the idea of Hevel contains this meaningless. Again, there is a meaning to that idol. It does stand for something, but particularly in comparison to God, it is meaningless. There's no substance to it. There's no weight to it. And so this is why Jeremiah, in the second chapter of his book, is able to use this similar term to question and ask Israel, why are you following after these vain and empty things? Why would you follow after idols? And Jeremiah chapter 2 and verse 5, Jeremiah speaking to Israel says, thus says the Lord, what injustice did your fathers find in me? That they went far from me and walked after emptiness and became empty. Again, your translation might have idol, it might have vanity, but it's that same word, Hevel. They did not say, where is the Lord who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, who led us through the wilderness, through a land of deserts and of pits, through a land of drought and of deep darkness, through a land that no one crossed and where no man dwelt. I brought you into the fruitful land to eat its fruit and its good things, but you came and defiled my land, and my inheritance you made an abomination. The priests did not say, where is the Lord? And those who handle the law did not know me. The rulers transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal, and walked after things that did not profit. And so we see how Jeremiah is using this word Hevel. Again, he's not saying it's a fictitious thing. You could go and point to the idols. You could tell, hey, this is where the idol of Baal is. And it's not meaningless in the sense that it's imaginary or it's thing. There's a thing there. They're doing something. But it is meaningless in the idea that this is not the God that brought you out of Egypt. This is not the God that you have sworn a covenant to. Moses says this is a demon. This is the work of the evil one that you are following. And yet you are surprised when you are led through difficult times. And so in the Old Testament picture, you could call an idol Havel, and somebody would understand what you were saying. You are putting your trust in something that has no substance. You are putting your trust in something that is not really going to be able to help you. And so this is a way that we can understand perhaps better the idea of Havel. It's like an idol. It's real in the sense that it physically exists. It's real in the sense that you can look at it. There's no power there. There's certainly nothing you would want to put your trust in. There's certainly nothing you would want to depend on with your life. But there's another idea to this of Havel. If you turn over to the book of Job, another poetic book and another part of the wisdom literature, Job, who we know, goes through an enormous amount of suffering, and in much of the book, has a pretty pessimistic outlook on life. When he's looking at what has happened around him, and he's seeing the damage that has been wrought in his life, he's seeing the hardship he's going through, and he's not particularly fond of life. And in fact, in the beginning of his speeches, he curses the day that he's born. And he wishes that he had never been brought to life at all, if this is what it was going to bring him. And so listen to what he says in chapter 7 of Job, in verse 13. In Job chapter 7, verse 13, towards the end of his speech here, he says, "If I say, my bed will comfort me, my couch will ease my complaint, then you frighten me with dreams and terrify me by visions, so that my soul would choose suffocation, death rather than my pains. I waste away. I will not live forever. Leave me alone, for my days are but a breath." That phrase, but a breath, that's Havel. And so Job says that my life, my days, are Havel. Now apply this concept here of, again, this word that we've been using, meaningless, this idea of Havel. Now we just talked about idols that they're there, there's something there, but there's nothing of substance. There's nothing to depend upon. It's not guaranteed like the Lord is guaranteed. It's not promised like the Lord is promised. And so Job is taking this idea and he's comparing his life to this. His life is bitter to him right now. His life does not feel like a gift, it feels like a punishment. And so he's looking at his life and his life is like a breath. That's what the base word Havel most basically translates to, is vapor or smoke. It's literally kind of that wispy substance. And if you've ever had smoke come up and if you've ever tried to grab smoke, you can see smoke. There's something physically there. But when you try to grab it, it slips through your fingers. It's there, but it has no substance. And even when you fly, admittedly not a vision that the original readers would have, but when you fly up in the air, have you ever noticed how dense the clouds look? I mean, the clouds just look like you could jump out of the airplane and just go bouncing on them. But you know that if you actually got into that cloud, you'd fall right through. There's no weight to it. There's no substance to it. And in fact, when you actually get into the midst of a cloud, or you get into the midst of fog, it actually becomes very confusing. It becomes very disorienting. It's very hard to see through that fog. And so he says, this is what my life is like. It's like this thing that I thought had a lot of substance to it, and I thought was wonderful and grand, and now it's just this bitter emptiness. It's this thing that upon closer inspection, there was really nothing there to it. And so this idea of Havel, this idea of a thing lacking substance, a thing lacking guarantee, I think this gives us a little bit more of an idea of how the Ecclesiastes author is going to use the word Havel. And so Havel to the Old Testament conception is not necessarily meaninglessness and that it doesn't exist or that there's no point to it, but there's confusion about it. There's almost an enigma is a way that some more modern translations will use. An enigma or absurd is another translation that's sometimes used. It's this thing that is confusing. It's not necessarily bad, although we see in the case of idols, it is used as a byword. It is used as a bad idea. But life is not intrinsically bad, but Job says there's pain in this. There's suffering in this. There's a bitterness that I have because of what has happened in my life. And so this word Havel, it's a very complex word. And hopefully you're seeing now why it would be so hard. How do you translate that? How do you grasp all of those meanings into one word? But let's dive a little bit deeper into this word. Let's look at how Ecclesiastes uses this word. Because he's going to start the book by saying, Hevel, Hevel, all is Hevel, vanity, vanity, all is vanities, all is an enigma, all is absurd. And he talks about a lot of different things that in his wisdom he has determined to be Hevel. And the list is actually pretty surprising of things that he gives this word that, even if it doesn't necessarily have an all bad connotation, it definitely is not an all positive connotation either. And so if you go back over to Ecclesiastes in chapter 2, we'll see some of the things that the author determines to be Hevel, that determines to be this enigma. And so in chapter 2 and verse 15, the preacher said, I said to myself, as is the fate of the fool, it will also befall me. Why then have I been extremely wise? So I said to myself, this too is vanity. This is Hevel. For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten. And how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life. For the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind. That last phrase, we see kind of that idea of trying to grab smoke, trying to grab the wind. It's an empty gesture. You can't do anything with it. But isn't this surprising? He's saying wisdom is Hevel. Wisdom is vanity. Now that's a surprising thing, because Ecclesiastes is part of the wisdom literature. And in fact, it's following a book with Proverbs that has really been extolling the virtues of wisdom. And if you only read this verse, you might look at the Ecclesiastes author and be like, wow, so you think wisdom is meaningless. You think there's no point to wisdom. Again, this is where some of the difficulty of translation comes in. I don't think the author is saying that wisdom is meaningless. And in fact, if you turn just a couple of chapters over in chapter 9 and verse 16, the Ecclesiastes author does not say wisdom is bad. He's not saying wisdom has no point. Because if you look in chapter 9 and verse 16, the author says, so I said, wisdom is better than strength. But the wisdom of the poor man is despised, and his words are not heeded. The words of the wise heard in quietness are better than the shouting of a ruler amongst fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. The point that the author is trying to make is not that wisdom is meaningless. It's not that wisdom has no point. He says wisdom is actually one of the best things in the world you can have. It is good to be wise. It is better to be wise than to be a fool. So he absolutely agrees with Proverbs. He absolutely agrees with the broader scope of the Old Testament. Wisdom is a good thing, and yet he still calls it Hevel. He still says there's this enigma about wisdom. And he says, I've noticed that the wise dies just like the fool. And he says, and that paradox, that confuses me. He says, I don't fully understand why that is, because wisdom is supposed to be this thing that grants you long life, prosperity to your bones, and Proverbs says if you're wise, you'll have a long family, you'll have a good life. And yet the Ecclesiastes author says, but that's not always the case. Sometimes wise people die and foolish people prosper. And that doesn't make sense to me. He says there's another thing that doesn't make sense to me. If you go back to Ecclesiastes chapter 6, the author says that prosperity is Hevel. Not just in the sense that wealth is Hevel. We would expect that, you know, just chasing after wealth is not a great thing. But he says even the blessings of prosperity are Hevel. In chapter 6 and verse 3, he says, if a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, however many that may be, but his soul is not satisfied with good things and he does not even have a proper burial, then I say better the miscarriage than he. For it comes in futility and goes into obscurity, and its name is covered in obscurity. It never sees the sun, and it never knows anything. It is better off than he. Even if the other man lives 1,000 years twice and does not enjoy good things, do not all go to one place. He says, all a man's labor is for his mouth, and yet the appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage does the wise man have over the fool? What advantage does the poor man have knowing how to walk before the living? What the eye sees is better than what the soul desires. This too is futility and a striving after wind. He says you can live a very long life and you can be very blessed by God. You can live 100 years and have many, many children, kind of the peak blessing of the day. And you would live long and that you would have many children. And he says, and yet, that doesn't guarantee happiness. That doesn't guarantee a purpose in life. And he says, this too is an enigma. This too confuses me. That the good things of life, the blessings of God, don't necessarily guarantee happiness. They don't necessarily guarantee what he would consider to be a good life. And he says, in fact, you can have all those things, and it would still be better if you were never born. Again, he doesn't say they're bad. He doesn't say that these things are not good. Again, if you go just a couple of chapters later, in chapter 9, a little bit before what we just read, in chapter 9 and verse 7, his advice to his reader, after he's telling them all these kind of hard and depressing things, he says in verse 7, go then, eat your bread in happiness and drink your wine with a cheerful heart, for God has already approved your works. Let your clothes be white all the time. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the woman whom you love all the days of your fleeting life, which he has given to you under the sun. For this is your reward in life and in your toil in which you have labored under the sun. He says, go enjoy life. Go work hard. Go enjoy the woman that you love. Go enjoy being in love. Go enjoy being a hard-working married person. But you notice that little phrase, your fleeting life. He doesn't want you to forget that there's still an enigma here. There is a havel about prosperity and long life. And he even says, you go one chapter before, in verse 10 of chapter 8, he says even righteous behavior is an enigma. In chapter 8 and verse 10, he says, so then I have seen the wicked buried, those who used to go in and out from the holy place, and they are soon forgotten in the city where they did this. This too is futility. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Although a sinner does evil 100 times and may lengthen his life, still I know that it will be well for those who fear God, who fear him openly. But it will not be well for the evil man, and he will not lengthen his days like a shadow because he does not fear God. But there is futility which is done on the earth. That is, there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked. On the other hand, there are evil men to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I say that this too is futility. So I commended pleasure. For there is nothing good for a man under the earth or under the sun except to eat and to drink and to be merry. And this will stand by him in his toils throughout the life, the days of his life, which God has given him under the sun. He says even righteousness has havel about it. And he affirms the idea that it is better to be righteous. He's not saying that righteousness is meaningless or pointless. But he's saying righteousness doesn't guarantee a good outcome. He says, I've seen righteous men die the fate of the wicked. And I've seen wicked men never punished in this life. That they die and they're honored in their city. And now everyone speaks well of their name. He says, this is an enigma to me. This is confusing. So do you see how the author of Ecclesiastes uses this word, havel? It's not that these things are pointless. It's not that these things are bad. He says all these things, you should pursue them. You should pursue wisdom. You should pursue hard work and a good life on this earth. You should pursue righteousness over wickedness. But he says there's still havel. Why? Why would he take these good things, these things that he approves of, and say that there's an enigma about them? In a very harsh tone, in a very hard words that the author of this book will say is like a goad. It's like a sharp stick that you'd use to poke a sheep in the side to get a move. These are sharp words that are meant to poke you. They're meant to kind of rouse you out of your sleep, to get you to think and to move. He says these words are hard. And he says, I want you to understand what the basis of life is. He says, all these things are an enigma. Because even these good things, they are like smoke in some capacity. And you cannot fully guarantee them. You cannot fully trust in them. that if you place the basis of your life on being wise, the author says that will fail you eventually. He says, the author, if you put the basis of your life as working hard and providing for your family, he says that too may fail because someday it may not have worked at all. Through forces completely outside of your control, you may be ruined. He says, and if your basis in life is simply being righteous, he says that won't guarantee anything either. Because there's wicked men that prosper all the time. There's righteous men that die young. So there's something deeper than these things. Again, they're not bad. They're not meaningless. But he says there is something deeper that we have to get to. At the conclusion of Ecclesiastes, in chapter 12, I've been saying the author, and that's actually a misnomer. The author of the book is different than the bulk of the book. The author of the book really only speaks for a couple of verses. And instead quotes this teacher, this preacher. And here we actually get the words of the author, that after he's given all these things, he's recorded all these things, we now get the author, the narrator, saying in chapter 12 and verse 9, he says, in addition to being a wise man, the preacher, the guy who's been saying all these things, also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write words of truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goad, these sharp sticks. And masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. At the conclusion of all things, the preacher has looked at all these things, and he concludes again that Havel, Havel, all is Havel. All is this enigma and this confusion. But the author wants to draw out one point that the preacher has made. And he says there is one thing that is not Havel. And it's not wisdom. It's not prosperity or hard work. It's not even righteousness. There is one thing that is not Havel. And that is to fear God and to keep His commandments. God is not Havel. God is solid. All these things, good, bad, all these things that life contains, ultimately, they are not solid enough to support our life. We cannot place our trust in anything but the Lord. And what I believe Ecclesiastes is trying to get us to understand is that it is too easy for us to place our trust in the good things of life. Even the things that are God-given. It's too easy for us to base our life on those things. And the Ecclesiastes author wants to strip that veneer away from us and say, even these things are not enough to build your life upon. The only thing that you can place your trust in is God Himself and your fear of Him. I hope that this year we have had some of that veneer stripped from our eyes. That in a year that has been very, very, very difficult for many of us, we have seen how many things in our life can be Havel. How many things in our life we may have placed our trust in, we may have grounded our identity in. And perhaps this year has helped reveal the truth of Ecclesiastes' word that those things are but an enigma. They are but smoke and vapor. Our work, our prosperity, it's Havel. You can lose your job so easily. You can lose your savings, your money, your house. We're seeing it all over this country. That a country that has prided itself on this incredible economic machine took one little microscopic virus to just kick it in the ground. It is Havel. Our national pride, our pride as Americans is Havel. We have seen a very difficult year in our nation, a series of several years that have been very difficult as our nation, that have hopefully stripped away any false illusion that this country, that this physical kingdom is worth placing our trust in. Because there's no kingdom that should have that. There's no kingdom that is anything but Havel. Again, remember, it's not saying it's all bad. It's not saying it's meaningless. But it is saying it's not something to place your trust in. It's not something to ground yourself in. Our relationships and our family life, are Havel. Not bad. Not meaningless. But that cannot be the ultimate thing we place trust in. Because unfortunately, we have seen a lot of people lose loved ones. We've seen a lot of people have damaged relationships because of this year. And it is terrible to see those things. But if we have placed our identity in being a part of a physical family, we have missed the idea that we need to be grounding ourselves in the family of the Lord. And perhaps we have even seen that our worship services, in a way, are Havel. Again, not meaningless. Not bad. But our worship services, our physical getting together here, cannot be the fullness of our relationship with God. Because we've just seen that this may not be able to happen. This is not guaranteed to us. And it could happen again in a variety of ways that we may not be able to physically worship. Perhaps even as an individual, there will be something that occurs with your health that you will not be able to come to worship services. And so I want to assure you that there must be more to your life with God than being here on Sunday and Wednesday. It's not bad, it's not meaningless, and it's not pointless. But if this is what you are grounding your life in, is simply the worship of God, and not the full fear and following of the Lord, you are placing your trust in something that is ultimately a smoke, something that will ultimately fade away. This is intended to be hard words, and I want us to see that this is the type of reaction that the readers of Ecclesiastes would have. The author of Ecclesiastes is taking everything that people typically hold dear, and he's saying it's all smoke. It's an enigma. It's something that is not guaranteed you in this life. So do not place your ultimate trust in it. Pursue it. Do good things. Pursue wisdom. Pursue happy life. Pursue hard work and righteous behavior. Pursue having a family. Be together with the family of God. But understand that there is only one thing that stays firm forever. And it is God Himself. There are many wonderful God-given blessings in this life. But we cannot let those blessings become a substitute for God Himself. There's only one God. And that is the only one we can place our trust in. It's intended to be a hard word, a sharp stick that jabs us in the side, that asks us to evaluate. Perhaps what have we placed too much trust in? Perhaps what have we let become our focus rather than God Himself? And it could be many things. There are many things in this life, good things, that can ultimately draw our attention away from the fear of the Lord. And I encourage you as we end this year, as we approach another one, think back on these things. Look at your life and perhaps look at what God has been trying to tell you, at what God has been revealing to you as Havel. And see in that revealing that God is trying to pull us closer to Him. That God ultimately wants us to trust in Him and Him alone. And if we trust in Him, there are many good blessings that we can enjoy and we can be a part of and we can appreciate in their proper context. But it all has to be grounded in the fear of the Lord and the following of His commandments. I encourage you to think on these things. Ecclesiastes is a hard book. It's meant to be. It's meant to be that sharp stick goading us in the side. And so if you're feeling a little bit of a jab in the side, good. This should be something that steps on our toes. This should be something that causes us to question what have we allowed Havel to infiltrate in our life. And so I encourage you, read these words. Look through the book of Ecclesiastes. See all the things that he talks about as Havel. And think about perhaps what have I placed my trust in that I need to refocus and reevaluate as trust in the Lord. The reason we can so deeply trust in the Lord, the reason He is not Havel and He is the solid foundation on which we can trust, is because His promises never fail. He has never been smoke that vanished upon closer inspection. He has always been true. He is truth and love to His people. And we're about to commemorate the most important act of that, where Jesus, God come in the flesh, maintained the promise of salvation for His people. So if there's one thing that we place our trust in, it is God. It is God come to earth, crucified for His people. And the promise that now resides for us that we too can join Him one day. That someday the Havel of life, the smoke and the fog and the enigmas and the confusion will all be wiped away. And we will see with eyes clearly the God that has always been our firm foundation. So if there's anything we can do to help you to gain clarity about who that God is. Won't you let us know while we stand and while we sing?